Like thousands of young Americans, Bill Ayers hated the war in Vietnam. But after years of marching and getting arrested, he decided his nonviolent protests didn't go far enough. He wanted to bring the war home. So his fringe group, the Weather Underground, set off a series of bombs around the country. Ayers lived on the run for a decade before finally turning himself in. Now, he's a professor in Chicago, and he's written a memoir called Fugitive Days. The timing of its publication could not have been worse. It came out right before the September 11th attacks. Critics quickly branded Ayers a terrorist. He recently sat down with Steve Paulson and talked about his radical past.
I was first arrested opposing the war in 1965. And by 1968, when Lyndon Johnson resigned the presidency, and we had a massive march on the home of the president of the University of Michigan, where I was a student, and he came out and addressed the crowd, and he said, "Congratulations, you've won, and we've won, and now there will be peace." And we believed it. And yet the war went on, as you know, for 7 more years, and millions of lives had to be lost. And what we saw, what I saw, was a war of terror against the whole people. And every day that we didn't end the war, 2,000 or 3,000 more human beings would be wiped out. And so it became quite a commitment, quite a despairing kind of moment, I think. But we were searching, trying to figure out how to raise the sharpest possible alarm against the war.
Was there a moment when you became, as you put it, you had been a rebel and you wanted to be a freedom fighter? Was there a moment that kind of pushed you to that extreme?
Sure. I think there were several moments. One certainly was being present in the riots in Cleveland in 1967. It was an incredible experience, 1966 and 67, the 2 years I spent in Cleveland, seeing the world through the eyes of really impoverished, ghettoized African-American community. And another time that I think was absolutely decisive was when I was a leader of Students for Democratic Society and Fred Hampton was killed, who had been a good friend. He was the leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago.
How was he killed?
He was murdered by the police and the state's attorney's office. And we knew it intuitively at the time. It only came out later that there was a program of the FBI. I'm not a big conspiracy buff, but there was a program to eliminate black leadership. We all know it now, although being the United States of amnesia, lots of us have forgotten. But lots of black leaders were killed in that time. And Fred was a particularly close associate friend. He was killed a mile from our home, and his body basically dumped on public display in our front yard.
When you say he was killed, the police just went in there and shot him?
Yeah, you should read the account because it's absolutely extraordinary. A police informant drugged him. Somebody who was in the Black Panther had infiltrated the Black Panther organization. He was drugged in his bed, and a group of police burst in, shooting, and killed Mark Clark and Fred Hampton and injured several others. The account that went out in the press, blaring account for the next several months, was that the Panthers had provoked it, had shot at the police. And the fact is, in the lawsuits that followed, proved that actually this was a written conspiracy on the part of law enforcement to kill Fred Hampton. They did it. They got away with it. I mean, they ended up paying his widow a large settlement. But the fact is that it wasn't a completely rare case in those days.
Tell me about the time when you did go underground. I mean, what you were trying to accomplish and some of the things that you did.
In 1970, the townhouse in Greenwich Village is blown up and 3 of my friends are killed, including my girlfriend, Diana Outen. And at that point, a group of us goes underground because we look forward and we see that people are being killed, that we are being beaten and harassed and arrested.
But just to be clear about that, explosion was presumably the people in that townhouse.
Absolutely.
Were the ones who accidentally
The three people who were killed were building bombs, that's right, and they set it off. And we always assumed that it was an accident. But we were then facing massive criminal charges. And our choice, it seemed to us at the time, was to spend the next several years defending ourselves in court, which we didn't trust and which we thought would be an entire waste of time, or to try to kind of survive on the run and continue to kind of protest the war using extreme and illegal means. And that's what we ended up doing.
And why did you choose to use those extreme means? I mean, to...
Well, because we, you know, as I said, I mean, we began the opposition to the war in 1965. By 1968, two things had happened. One is that Vietnam vets were returning, adding a sense of urgency and a sense of intensity to the anti-war movement. And they were saying, this is an atrocity that we're committing over there. It's a war of terror against a people. It's not a legitimate war. It's not legal. It's not moral. It has to stop. So from 1968 to 70, we intensified our efforts to stop that war. And the war went on. And there was no end in sight. Richard Nixon won the presidency with a secret plan to end the war. The secret plan turned out to be to escalate the war. And so a group of us decided that we were going to, you know, sound an alarm that was more intense and more urgent than any that had been sounded before. You know, in many ways, and I don't know how you read the book, but in many ways I read the book as a meditation on terrorism and a rejection of terrorism, both terrorism by individuals and by groups, but also official terrorism.
It's fascinating to hear you say that this is a meditation against terrorism. Of course, the charge has been leveled at you that you were a terrorist. You were blowing up buildings, weren't you?
Well, we were using not only extreme means, but even in some cases violent means to try to end this war. No, we weren't terrorists. Terrorism is the targeting of people, the targeting of innocents. What we saw September 11th was, of course, a huge and clear example of a crime against humanity, of terrorism, not only a monstrous act, but in the service of a monstrous ideology. And that's what we just witnessed. But what we witnessed 30 years ago was government policy that said, here, let me draw a circle around large swaths of this country. Anyone living there can be killed and murdered. And so the recent revelations, which we've all forgotten apparently very quickly, of Senator Robert Kerry going into a village, and the dispute is over, did they kill 10 or did they kill 28 or 40? That's the only question in dispute. The fact is they entered a village and slit the throats of old people and children in the service of this conquest of Vietnam. That was terror. I actually have one chapter in which I actually describe two groups of young people, both of them despairing, both of them a little bit off the track, one terribly frightened and one terribly determined. One group of young people fashions a 3-pound bomb to slip into the Pentagon to go off in the middle of the night as a symbolic act against the killing. No one was killed. No one was injured. In fact, no one was ever killed or injured in the actions that we did. And the second group of young people marches into a Vietnamese village, kills 347 people over a 6-hour period, rapes, loots, burns, and I raise the question, which is terrorism? Both are violent, both are illegal, but which is terrorism?
What were you trying to accomplish strategically by setting off these explosions?
We were trying, I think, to say to the government and to the American people, this war has created such a crisis that it's coming home, that if you continue this mass murder, we will go places you don't want us to go. And we did it again and again, and we did it as part of the anti-war movement. And as I say, we never intended to kill anybody, and we never did kill anybody. So I see that, and I don't know why other people don't, but I see that as a huge moral distinction.
So you don't have regrets about what
you
did?
Oh, I have 1,001 regrets. I mean, I'm 56 years old. When you get my age, you'll have a lot of regrets too.
But to focus on what we've been talking about, the violence, the explosions.
I would say that, you know, I regret anybody's feelings who were hurt. I regret anybody that I harmed. You know, I've been listening to this new Bob Dylan album, which I love, and he says, you know, I know that you're sorry, I'm sorry too. And in a way, you get to be our age and you have to kind of say that. Sure, I'm sorry about a lot of things, but if I look at that progression of activity against the war, I actually think we were tremendously restrained. Had somebody been hurt or killed, that would be indefensible. I think what happened here at Madison, the killing of that researcher, was indefensible.
Well, let me follow up on that, because that happened less than a mile from where we're sitting right now. the Army Math Research Center at the University of Wisconsin was blown up. The bomb was set off in the middle of the night. The intention was not to kill anyone. That's why they did it then. Unfortunately, tragically, someone was in the building then. They didn't know that. A researcher was killed. One of the bombers, Carl Armstrong, has since come out and expressed great public regret, remorse.
As I think he should.
But couldn't that easily have happened with you? I mean, weren't you just lucky that no one was killed in any of these
explosions? I think we were lucky, but I also think we were thoughtful and restrained. As I say, I think that the restraint is something worth noting. So I think it's absolutely marvelous that Carl Armstrong expresses remorse, expresses regret, because one person was killed and that's a whole universe that was destroyed. And so I don't have any doubt that that was tragedy, that if I had been involved in that, I would be expressing deep, deep remorse. But what I don't get is why, for example, Robert Carey can't express remorse, and why it is that the Carl Armstrongs are always called to task, because what they did was extreme, without a doubt, but not as extreme as what was done every day in our name. In fact, quite restrained. In the 3 years or 4 years that we're talking about, there were something like 20,000 bombings and arson incidents in the United States against war-related targets. And as far as I know, one person was killed. That's restraint, in my view. That's restraint. And as far as I know, every day that the war in Vietnam went on, 2,000 people were killed.
Let me mention another reaction to your book, the review that was in The Nation by John Leonard, and I want to quote here. He says, "Don't tell me that you had to be there to feel Weather's rage. We were there, and most of us thought that they were bonkers, renegade splinters of the fractured New Left, imagining themselves to be samurai or Sioux, boxers or Bolsheviks, turned violent." You can debate where he falls politically, but writing for The Nation, generally a publication of the left. What do you make of that kind of criticism?
I think I said something similar in the book, actually. I think I said something about the extent to which we kind of had a metaphor of ourselves that was super inflated and way beyond what we were capable of. So I don't feel that the book in any way defends our self-righteousness, defends the errors that we made in terms of turning away from the mass movement. But I think it's very easy now, 30 years later, to kind of stand on the high ground of middle age and throw rocks into the valley of youth. And did we splinter and factionalize and fracture? We did. And we are partly responsible for that. But again, it's easy to kind of look back and say, oh, I would have done it this way. Well, how did he do it? I mean, what was the right answer? I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Bill Ayers, talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir, Fugitive Days. Ayers lived on the run for a decade. In 1981, he and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, turned themselves in. She served 7 months in jail. Charges against Ayers were dropped because of government misconduct. Today, he's a professor of education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And he's getting a lot of hate mail since his book came out.